There, do you have any idea what you're listening to?
London Philharmonic?
It's Venus.
Uh-huh.
Venus.
Why not? We bounced signals off the moon's surface. There's no reason that Venus shouldn't radiate impulses.
I don't mean the static. Can't you hear it, the other thing?
What other thing?
Listen to it, Paul. Listen to the voice.
Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is the weekly critical look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman. I'm your host. Drew Jerico, producer, is at the controls. On today's program, pirates making waves in Tucson, Arizona. We have an interview with Michael Leahy, an independent documentary filmmaker, who recently released a DVD of his film Making Waves, which looks at a very interesting scene of three different pirate radio stations in that city. And of course, we'll catch you up on all the news of our media environment. Do stay tuned. Each week here on Media Geek, we try to keep you up to date on news of our media environment. It's stories which often get left out of TV and radio news, and otherwise get shunted to the back of the business pages of in our print newspapers. But we think these are stories about communications and democracy, and deserve to be right up there at the top of the show. New Jersey may be the next state to make unlicensed radio broadcasting a crime under state law, but this time a felony. That is, if a bill passed by the Assembly's Telecommunications Committee is passed by the full legislature and signed by the governor. The bill under consideration was pushed by the New Jersey Broadcasters Association. If the bill is signed into law, New Jersey would become the second state to outlaw unlicensed broadcasting at the state level. Florida implemented a law this year making unlicensed broadcasting a misdemeanor. Local New Jersey radio broadcasters are finding themselves under increasing pressure from New York City and Philadelphia-based stations owned by the largest broadcast conglomerates. Stations that serve both these markets also cover most of New Jersey's largest population areas, making it difficult for locally owned stations to compete. Unfortunately, the NJBA is choosing to chase down the smallest stations, presumably because it would take major changes in broadcast ownership regulation to provide them with relief from the likes of Clear Channel and Infinity. The NJBA has also petitioned the FCC to put stricter limits on 100-watt licensed low-power FM stations and translator stations within New Jersey. The petition also asks the FCC to ban all stations under 100 watts from operating in the state at all, including 10-watt low-power FM stations, which have yet to be opened for licenses. The FCC opened that petition for public comment in October, but it only received 7 comments, with 4 of those in support of the NJBA's demands. State-based initiatives may turn out to be the next frontier in broadcasters' attempts to solidify as much control over the radio airwaves as possible.
One radio station operator in California would like to see Howard Stern obey the same indecency rules he has to heed now on broadcast radio when he moved to satellite radio in 2005. Mount Wilson Broadcasters, owner of 1FM and 2AMs, has filed a petition for rulemaking with the FCC, arguing that since indecency regulation applies to expression, quote, by means of radio communications, end quote, then it should apply to satellite radio as well. Earlier this year, when Stern announced his plan to move to Sirius satellite radio, one of the main reasons he cited was his desire to escape the radio indecency rules, which curtail much of what he can say on morning radio, and have earned his parent company, Viacom, millions in fines. At issue in the Mount Wilson petition is whether or not satellite radio is considered to actually be like broadcast radio, or whether it is more like a subscription service, such as cable and satellite TV. The Supreme Court has already ruled that the subscription cable TV channels, like the Playboy Channel, that show programming which would be considered indecent on broadcast television, are not subject to broadcast indecency regulations.
It's kind of an interesting case there. It seems like it's sour grapes there, that California broadcaster. I don't know if that owner carries Howard Stern on one of the stations, since it's not just on Viacom stations. Mm-hmm. It's syndicated all over the country and all different companies. So maybe he's ticked off at losing the income. I don't know.
I think they've been. I read a little bit about this story too, and I think they've been doing some collaborations with Clear Channel Markets in the California area, which of course is one of Viacom's main competitors.
And Clear Channel has also suffered millions
and
in fines from the FCC, and so this may be what is the typical inter-industry squabbling, mm-hmm. wherein the FCC is being called on to play referee between different sectors in the industry. And again, it's another situation which gives a lie to the whole notion of deregulation, right? And with one side of their mouth, the Viacoms, the Clear Channels, and our broadcast companies say, take off these pernicious regulations, free us from your indecency rules. And then the other side of their mouth, they say, but put those rules on those other guys who have an entirely different, you know, schema for transmitting their stuff because they're going to take away our listeners. So it's not really about being free. It's not really about a free market. It's just about being as free to do what you want while sticking the regulations on the other guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we'll go here to our feature, and that is an interview with Michael Leahy. He is a independent filmmaker and documentarian, previously living in Tucson, Arizona. Now he lives in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I had a great pleasure of meeting and hanging out with Michael when I was at the Radio Access Democracy Conference 2 weeks back, which was sponsored by the Walker Art Center and the Minneapolis College of Art and Design up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And Michael, he is an alum of the University of Illinois and Northern Illinois University. And his documentary is called Making Waves. And it is about three stations in Tucson, Arizona, all unlicensed, and the various travails they go through. And I will have to say, quite frankly, it is the best movie I've seen on the subject so far. And I've seen a couple of documentaries, some longer, some shorter. And this is probably, both in terms of the production values and really the story, how well it was put together and how well it kind of sucks you in for its hour and some minutes, really one of the best treatments I've seen on the subject. So Michael's going to tell us a little bit more about the film. You hear some clips in between, and why don't we go to that interview right now.
Coming to a transmitter near you.
Somewhere in the ballpark of, you know, 2,500 radio stations like this have cropped up all over the country.
Our pirate radio in the house.
Your film Making Waves is about some unlicensed radio operators in Tucson, Arizona. Can you tell me a little bit more about the stations that you focus on?
Sure. There were three stations that were operating unlicensed simultaneously in 2000, which is when I started this project. The main station that I focused on, KRVL, was a station that was very much in the open, unlike a lot of the more clandestine pirate radio stations. They were giving out where they were on the air. They had a huge sign in front of their building that said, it was a quote from Thomas Jefferson, "Never trust your government, tune into 94.3 FM. So that was the main station that I focused on, and I found them to be very interesting in the fact that they weren't hiding and that this was going to come to a head in some way, I felt. I didn't know how that was going to be. Either is the FCC going to come and shut them down? Are they going to get a big enough following that even if the FCC does come, it will be moot, or maybe the community can take a hold? Or will they be unable to sustain it and implode? Those were kind of the three options with them. Through KRVL, I found that there was another station that was open, that was operating in the open, and that was KOPC, which was also called Free Radio Tucson. And they were another station that was in the open, but they weren't giving out their address of where they were at. Although, if you went by the house and saw the gigantic antenna coming out from it, it didn't look like your normal little rabbit ears or, you know, antenna going on there. And then the third station was Radio Limbo, which I had been listening to for several years, and they operated in the I guess, for lack of a better term, the typical clandestine type of hiding from the FCC, moving the transmitter from place to place. And So one station led to the others, and I just started seeing what was going to happen with these guys.
You're listening to Freedom Radio, 94.3 FM.
You're listening to Free Radio Tucson, free speech for the Southwest.
So why did you decide to make a documentary about them?
Well, initially, the term, I had never even heard the term low power radio before, or micro radio. I had heard only pirate radio. And my initial impetus for the documentary was Shane Eden, who was a public access celebrity, so to speak. He had had a show running for 16 years that had originally started as kind of a variety show and had then morphed into what he would call a constitutional patriot type of hour-long program. And I had heard about him, had met him, thought he was an interesting character. He happens to look a lot like Santa Claus, so he was interesting. I thought in front of the camera he would look quite good, and he had taped all of his shows for 16 years, so I thought that maybe a compilation film would be interesting about him. But then he also was running this unlicensed radio station, which was KRVL that I mentioned earlier, and when he told me about the station, he said, you should tune in, and I started listening to it. And it was unlike just about any other station I had heard before. This was just before the 2000 election. And although there was political media that was being played, you know, almost the whole time on there, none of it had to do with Bush or Gore. And it was mostly talking about individual rights. It was talking about the Constitution. It was talking about issues of sovereignty, and these were issues that I had heard very little of my whole life, and I thought, this is an interesting group, and what would they be interested in an election year? After that, I just kind of became more about the micro-radio movement.
Keep it right there. You're listening to 94.3 FM, Your Rights Radio Without Licensing. The goal of this radio station is to help draw people out of poverty consciousness and into greater affluence, out of violence and into something more peaceful, out of injustice and into something more tolerant. The Arizona Constitution says the purpose of Arizona government is to protect and maintain individual rights. Do you know what your individual rights are? Keep listening.
So the film is about the micro-radio movement, but it's really told through the story, especially of this one station, but and in the other stations in Tucson, right?
Right. Yes, KRVL is kind of the main, they're kind of the test case. You get to see them from start to finish. What was the inception? What were the dynamic? Because they split with Free Radio Tucson, and what were the issues that caused them to split, and then you get to see them try to recruit, the technical issues that they have to fight through, how they are they building a following, and then ultimately what happens to the station. And in between there, of course, a visit from the FCC. So you get to see more of this station because they had kind of the full arc during the time that I was filming, which lasted about 10 months. The other stations are used more as supplemental stations to see some diversity, because I try to contrast with Radio Limbo, which was the clandestine station, of how they operate, what they really were apolitical in a certain sense. I mean, the music that they played was clearly, I would say, had messages that were, you know, anti-corporate and that kind of thing. But overall, I think that they were in stark contrast to the way that KRVL was operating. It certainly raises the issue during the course of the film of what's the better route. You know, by being out in the open, did that ultimately help KRVL or did it hurt them? And with Limbo being hidden, did that ultimately, extend their life.
Right. And KRVL is not only out in the open, but they, you know, with this very sharp focus on individual rights and constitutional rights, I mean, they do so, they're out in the open because they want to make that statement.
Right. Right. And I think one of the things that drew me to this is that not just this group, but this group in particular, lived largely in a world of abstraction before they took on the radio station. In other words, they talk about that there's this huge disconnect between the original tenets of the Constitution and where our laws are today. And what I thought was interesting is through two examples, one was through the radio station and the other was through Marshall Home, one of the main characters. He does not use a driver's license or a license plate on his car. And those two examples provide the viewer with the way that they took their abstract views and actually put them out in the open. And one of the things I was curious about is how will this play out? In other words, will the public accept it? And Marshall even asked that question during the course of the film. Or will the public reject it, you know, without giving the film away? I think that the internal factors proved surprisingly more of a impedance than the external factors.
You are listening to Freedom Radio 94.3 FM on your radio dial. This is constitutional, unlicensed radio. You don't need a license to talk to one another.
And you are listening to an interview with Michael Leahy. He is the filmmaker, documentarian behind a film called Making Waves, which is about pirate radio, about the free radio movement in general, and specifically about three stations in Tucson, Arizona. And you are listening to Media Geek, your weekly look at the world of grassroots, independent media, and a critical look at our media environment. My name is Paul Reisman. I'm your host. Andrew Tirico, our producer, is at the controls. And of course, when the show isn't on, you can check us out online, www.mediageek.org, where you can download past programs in MP3 in the open source Ogg Vorbis format, and you can also look at the Media Geek blog to find out the news that just can't make it on to the show. So now we're going to return to our interview with Michael Leahy, filmmaker behind Making Waves.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Check, test, test, test. All right.
I think what sets Making Waves apart from a lot of documentaries about issues like pirate radio or other similar movements is that it's character-driven. Because you flesh out these folks like Shane, like Augie, and especially Marshall. Why did you choose that approach?
You know, in my documentary filmmaking, I've always thought that the characters are what's going to make a story. That the issue can be an important one, and people make issue-driven documentaries. It's not really what I'm interested in. I'm much more influenced by people like Studs Terkel and people like that that take quote-unquote everyday people and show either the heroicism or tragic sides of them. And so it started with the characters. And as I said earlier, I knew nothing about low-power radio at the time. I knew that radio had reached a deplorable state in the years leading up to me starting the film, but I didn't know the reasons why. I didn't know about the Telecom Act of 96. I didn't know. I just started to hear about Clear Channel. Now that's an everyday thing, but in 2000, you know, I didn't know about it. I didn't know about Infinity Broadcasting. I didn't know about a lot of these big issues of the reason. You know, there were reasons why radio had reached such a sorry state, and it wasn't just because programmers were, you know, somehow losing their taste. So as I found out about that and learned more and more about it, I felt like there was no way I could tell their story of these unlicensed pirates without also telling the larger picture of the low-power movement. I soon found I was over my head in a lot of ways because it's such a complicated thing. Certainly had I known about all the complexities before then, I don't know if I would have even done this documentary, but I was already in it and I felt like this had to be told in order to hopefully get some people involved in a story that if it was just a technical story and if it was just about low power, they might not get into it. But because it's these characters who I found very interesting and not typical of other stories that I had seen, that you could combine the issue and the characters.
So turning to like more of the production, How long did it take you to shoot all of the footage for this film?
The filming of the major filming took about 10 months, and it started in September of 2000, and then ended at the end of June of 2001. I did another trip down to Tucson in 2003 to film some more of Radio Limbo's footage, and then I had people toward the end when I needed certain shots. I had friends in Tucson that I was calling up from Minneapolis and saying, hey, can you go out and get me this, this, and this? You know, I need antenna shots. I needed a courtroom shot towards the end. And so I still had some contacts there. My director of photography, who's now out in Hollywood, shot car radio stuff at the last minute that I needed. So there was all kinds of that type of thing, but the major filming was 10 months.
And you did this all on mini DV, on basic, mm-hmm. you know, digital camcorders.
Correct. It was all shot on a Canon XL1 mini DV camera.
So you were not using high-end pro equipment. In fact, this is very much a very independent film.
Yes. Other than a $500 mini grant, mini being the operative word, from Tucson Public Access, this, I funded the entire thing. But I was able, during the course of the filming and the post-production, to find people to provide in-kind services that totaled, you know, tens of thousands of dollars. They saw the footage and saw that the issue was important and found the characters interesting, and I was just very lucky to find these talented people that wanted to contribute.
So, what is your training then as a filmmaker?
Well, it's almost all self-taught, I guess. I did my first documentary as part of my master's degree in film theory from Northern Illinois University. And I made a documentary called Tugs Untied and kind of fell in love with the whole process. But unfortunately, because I made that choice, rendered my master's degree pretty much worthless as far as the production field went. And when I started down in Tucson and I was saying, hey, yeah, do you have any work? They'd say, well, what have you done? Meaning, do you have a reel? What other stuff? And I had only done this low-end documentary that was shot on VHS and high eight. So it was difficult. So I had to pretty much start over again. Finding a good topic and good characters will take you a lot further than knowing how to get perfect lighting and to make everything sing. Having said that, you know, a lot of the things that I would do is try to find people that you can collaborate with. Because if you're doing it all yourself, there's going to be some stages where you're going to be better than others. And, you know, your film can suffer perhaps from lighting and from other things that if you don't have any training in it and you can't find a talented person to, a more experienced person to do it, then the film will suffer for it.
And so how could someone see Making Waves?
The film has played in some film festivals and will continue to be entered into film festivals in the upcoming months. And I have done a couple of benefit screenings for Free Radio Santa Cruz, and also an upcoming one I think is going to happen in Boulder. So a couple of people have contacted me directly about that. My website is www.jumpcutfilms.com, and if you do a /makingwaves, you get right to the Making Waves page, and then there's a contact email that you can contact me there, or you can contact me. My phone number is 612-724-5202, and you can buy DVDs online.
And that's an interview with Michael Leahy. He's the filmmaker and documentarian behind Making Waves, a documentary about pirate radio, the micro radio movement and pirate radio specifically in Tucson, Arizona. And his website is www.jumpcutfilms.com. And before we wrap up, Drew, one little bit of news we thought we'd share with people is the insistence by FCC Chairman Michael Powell that he will be staying in the chairship at the FCC, I guess, is provided he's wanted, which I guess we're to assume he is.
I think we can safely assume that.
So we will not be seeing major changes at the FCC, although, as we mentioned last week, we will be seeing the leave of Jonathan Adelstein, who is a Democrat and been probably one of the most outspoken FCC commissioners in quite some time when it comes to issues like media ownership and free speech on the airwaves, which is one of the reasons I'm sure he's not wanted any longer.
Do you know who his possible replacement could be?
I don't have my notes on me, so I don't offhand remember who it is. Curious. I believe it's Representative an assistant to Representative John Dingell, of a Democrat from Michigan, but I don't remember this person's name. It's somebody who is a little bit more mainstream telecom. Although, quite frankly, before he was on the commission, Jonathan Adelstein looked a little bit more mainstream telecom, too. He's kind of young, but he was very much a policy wonk. So I think it would surprise a lot of people that he took a much more radical note. Michael Copps, I'm certain, will be sticking around. He's made quite a name for himself. He's the other very outspoken Democratic commissioner on the FCC. Of course, he will be in the minority there. And there will be someone to replace Kathleen Abernathy, whose term is up in 2005. My guess is they're certainly going to pick somebody who will fall in lockstep with Michael Powell so as to solidify that Republican majority, which will probably just mean things will be status quo, which means very good for the broadcast and telecom industry in looting the public airwaves.
Business as usual.
Business as usual.
That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. We'll be back in 1 week with more news and views on our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek on the web at www.mediageek.org. There you can read the Media Geek blog for news that can't fit onto the show, as well as download archive episodes of the program in MP3 in the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. If you have any comments about the program, please send them to paul@mediageek.org. I'm host and executive producer Paul Riesmandel. Our producer is Drew Tirico. Media Geek is produced live at community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Some pre-production happens at the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center. Media Geek is also heard on KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho, and on KQRP in Salida, California. And Media Geek is free to broadcast on your local non-commercial station, too. To inquire, please send email to paul@mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.